Welcome back. I'm Pierre Daly. This is Insight is Capital. Today, we're going straight to the source on one of the biggest questions in Canadian portfolios. Where is the money actually going, and why are so many new ETFs being launched to catch it? Our guest is Ron Landry, Vice President and Head of Segment Solutions and Canadian ETF Services at CIBC Mellon. From his seat working with ETF issuers, trading desks, and service providers across the street, Ron has an institution-wide view of how flows are moving and how that is shaping the next generation of ETF products. If you're an advisor trying to separate durable trends from short-lived fads, this is your chance to eavesdrop on the vantage point that sees flows and product formation across the whole Canadian market.
This is Insight is Capital. Join us in our fireside chats with some of the most fascinating people in finance to discuss their insights on life, markets, macro, investment strategy, and much more.
Ron, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us. It is terrific to have you back.
Yeah, it's great. Thank you very much, Pierre. I enjoy our conversations.
A year has gone by since our last, and it's hard to imagine what kind of year it's been. I mean, it's been a crazy year and a half so far, crazy 16 months, of course, since last January. Last year's sentiment was completely different. I felt like last year when we talked last year, we were sort of in a holding pattern, that we were just coming out of a holding pattern in markets. This year is entirely different. So Ron, thank you again for coming back for our catch up this year. High level, right off the bat, I'm curious to know how you would describe the year it's been since the last time we spoke.
2025 was an amazing year for the ETF industry here in Canada. And, we thought, how can we continue the pace? And it has continued. Like, it is just, the flows are being knocked down park. So far as of May, almost at $95 billion in net flows for 2026. That's 57% ahead of last year's run rate. We're looking at about like $20 billion coming in month over month. And we've already collected almost two-thirds of the assets that we collected last year in flows. So it's mind-boggling the amount of money that's flowing into ETFs here in Canada.
So I take it you're busy.
We are. I think the industry is busy.
Everybody always is.
Right. And what you're seeing from that effect is the number of discussions we're having with what we'll call traditional mutual fund asset managers. That historically, even I wouldn't have said, 5 or 6 months ago, if I said to them, "Are you looking at ETFs?" Their answer would be absolutely not. But I think they're realizing there is a subset of investors who will never look to a mutual fund as an investment tool. So, they're like, okay, well, how do we get access to that cohort of investors? And, the easy way for them is if they have good, strong products with good track records, is really to add an ETF series to that. But, those are the conversations that we're having simply because they are seeing the flows going in ETFs. And yes, mutual funds had a positive flow rate last year, still well below what ETFs have done. And they've had a decent record this year, but still well behind what ETFs are doing. And so I think they're realizing that if they don't do something, they're missing the flow right towards ETFs, and they're missing a whole, generation of investors who are looking for, platforms that are digital in nature, self-directed, do-it-yourselfers are a big trend, and they want to access those products through ETFs today. It's hard to understand the record flows that we're seeing. Like, you look at the market volatility that we're seeing, you're tariff noise, the Middle East geopolitical risks that we're seeing. You know, April saw almost $13 billion come into equities. Like it, you know, if there was a time to sort of pull back and look at, you know, high interest savings or money market or fixed income, or you would think this would be the time. But the flows are still just going crazy. And, you know, the nuance that we're seeing is there's, you know, not a detraction from investing in U.S. equities, but definitely more towards Canadian emerging markets. International products as well are starting to see that flow. Right. We've had, you know, global developers, emerging markets, you know, $7.1 billion in January, $4.3 billion in April. So we are seeing people looking at diversifying their flows. But, you know, U.S. is still a big market.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody's making a decision to exit U.S. equities. Maybe the decision that's been, you know, sort of unfolding in the last year is, and a little longer, is a rotation or rebalancing into other markets, into Canada for one, for Canadian investors in particular, but also global and international mandates as well, right? When you look across the ETF mandates and platforms that you touch, What are the biggest flow trends that you're seeing right now in Canada? I know we've sort of touched on it, and how do those flows line up or clash with the macro stories people think are driving portfolios? It seems pretty obvious that like there's two things going on in the market, right? There's some concern about the geopolitical situation that we've got. And then on the other side, investors are looking at, you know, the CapEx commitments for AI, for example, for infrastructure, like the $650 billion figure that's floating around, you know, in trillions over the next couple of years. That's one thing. And then there's also a lot of hoopla around these upcoming IPOs that we're seeing, you know, Anthropic, OpenAI, SpaceX, right? Yeah. Those are generating a lot of fervor in the market, a lot of froth.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah. Well, how do you? Yeah.
Yeah. So what we are seeing is, you know, a lot of single stock ETFs. A lot of came out last year. I think there was 80. I think we're like in the 20 mark so far this year. You're seeing, you know, cover calls is still a big idea when it comes to launching products. Paying products are really interesting. You're seeing this new trend, and I'll call it new because I think it's new-ish, is, you know, increased number of distributions, right? So you're getting, you know, twice a month, you got somebody trying to do weekly. You try to think about, like, what is it that people are trying to achieve with that? Because a lot of the asks are coming from investors who, in theory, you would think these would be investors who are retired, looking for consensual cash flow, but it's actually coming from a younger cohort. It's almost like they're investing in these products, but they want a paycheck on a biweekly basis or coming out of their investment. So it's really interesting from that perspective. But when you look at the overall flows and you look at the where flows are going, you know, still barring a couple of outliers, is still going to the top 10 issuers, right? They make up almost 85-86% of the flows this year. You look at the products that are selling well, where the money is going in, you are still looking at index type products that are very specific. You know, I'd say they're core to anybody's portfolio. And then you have these, you know, thematic niche type products where people are just doing silo investments, right? So they want to round out the overall portfolio, and they're making a tactical pick on where they think things are going, but ultimately they're still buying large, you know, index-based products. We are seeing an increase in asset allocation products. So all, you know, one ticket trades, right? And that's, you know, you look at the top three issuers and they've done really, really well with those type of products. iShares, Vanguard, BMO have done really, really well with all in one. Yeah. So, you know, that has seen a lot of pickup as well. The top three control like 92% of the assets in that space, right? So, as much as we're seeing a lot of what I would say really innovative products come to market, there's still a heavy flow to what we'll call traditional passive product, whether it's on the equity side, the fixed income side. And then you're getting, you know, the desire for yield or payment or income. And that's where, you know, you're seeing some uniqueness. And then you still have your money market and cash products that, you know, have so far this year, like either a lot of money's going in or a lot of money's going out. And I think it's all around investor sentiment at a particular point in time, but, you know, April saw a huge flow out in April out of HISA and money market product, right? So I don't know if they thought because the war was almost done, it was time to sort of jump back in, but we saw a huge sort of move out of cash and then back into equities and fixed income.
I might actually feel like a bit of a FOMO signal, right? I mean, when you see suddenly, you know, there's been a lot of chatter like across markets about so-called, you know, $9 trillion sitting in short-term instruments, you know, either in the, you know, low end of the yield curve or in money market funds for quite some time, that there's a huge amount of liquidity sort of peripheral to the market. And then, you know, you have these events like we had last month unfold that, you know, shot the market to new record highs that closing Friday after the Strait of Hormuz. Well, it's, you know, nothing's changed. You know, I sort of jumped on it that Monday saying, well, it's, you know, the Strait of Hormuz is finally on, you know, the blockade is finally opened up. But in reality, nothing's actually changed, right? But but the sentiment is that, you know, this conflict is going to be wrapped up soon and there's much bigger fish to fry, or something more important seems to be driving that surge. What do you think, Ron, has changed the most in the last 12 to 18 months? The market seems to be signaling something completely different.
If you read the stories and then you didn't have insights to what the markets were doing, you'd be surprised the markets were actually still growing at those rates, right? Like you look at inflation's going up, the cost of living is going up, interest rates are not really coming down at this point, because now you've got central banks going like, okay, well, inflation was going down, we're now back on the upswing, you know, do we really want to be increasing inflation anymore? So, you know, we need to keep interest rates steady. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if we saw interest rates go up if this war doesn't sort of curtail itself.
From your vantage point, you know, you get to see which types of ETF strategies asset managers are lining up to launch. What are some of the dominant themes in ETF formation today? Now, without obviously naming any names or getting specific with who's bringing what, but what do those pipeline conversations tell you about where manufacturers think advisors and investor demand is going?
Yeah. So I think there's a lot of interest, and especially in that we'll say non-bank owned channels around, you know, what are the do-it-yourselfers looking for? And so, you know, we are still seeing a lot of what I'll call income yield generating paying type products, probably moving a little closer to more dividend, even cover call equity type products that are really resonating. Like I said, the single stock ETFs are doing strong. We do have some interest, you know, around still what could be done in the crypto space. Digital asset space is still interest around, you know, is what's the next coin that would come out? Or, you know, we have some players that are now revisiting, you know, should we jump in at this point? So even though we have a handful of issuers, but there are some issuers that are actually looking at the space. Because I think they think there's an opportunity to make an allocation into that. They think it's still viable as a, you know, a sliver or an investment portion of somebody's portfolio, and how do you sort of build that in? And I think, you know, at least for the next 3 years, it's an area of interest for anybody, right? Because you have a government or that is really interested in continuing to promote crypto
right.
From that perspective. So there's still a lot of tailwind there for the area. Who knows what happens after that? But, you know, I think the what I like about digital assets in general is, you know, let's get this crypto away, but I think that the technology, what it does, where it's going, you know, you have the CSA now doing tokenization workshops, right? So there is a drive towards what we'll call digital assets. May not be crypto,
right.
But, you know, the tokenization, stable coins, tokenized deposits, these are all areas that I think that both investment managers, advisors, brokers, dealers, banks are all looking at. This is a trend. How do we sort of get there? And I think Canada's going to be a little slower than maybe the US, but it's definitely a topic of interest within the ecosystem. And
right.
So I think what you'll, you know, on top of trying to keep pace with new innovative products, you know, and whether that's like, you know, still picking back off of tech and AI and, you know, all those type of things, it's, you know, what are the products that we can bring forward that will sort of fit within that realm, right? And it's not necessarily the buying of tokens to hold within a portfolio, but it may be, you know, how do we make our products accessible through a digital platform of some sort? So
right.
Those are things that is changing, you know, or it could change, right? Like, you know, do we, you know, I think it's still going to be a regulated, well-regulated sort of structure. You know, we'll still have some sort of central depository that's ultimately responsible, but maybe the rails that people are selling or trading on or whatever is going to change, right? I think the only way we get to T0 is a change or a disruption in the technology that's being used today. Right. And so, that I think there's a lot of thought within the industry, top of, you know, new product innovation, but how did we do that? And then I think we have a lot of clients who are paying a lot of attention to the fact of, you know, TCR, right? So
right.
The first time a client's going to see what TCR really looks like is next January, February. But I think, you know, asset managers are really conscious of the fact that what is actually going to show up on a client's statement? And should we be a little more conscious of the fact that we need to make sure that we're not overcharging our clients? Fees is still a discussion, rightly or wrongly, but it's still a discussion. You know, fees aren't everything. So, you know, I think my general view is the returns are there. I'm not overly concerned about what the fees are.
Right.
You know, I'd rather pay a little more in fees and get consistent returns than, you know, pick the lowest cost provider and have swings of 10-20% one way or the other in any given year. Right. So, you know, I think it is a topic that advisors need to be able to speak to. I think it's going to be probably, you know, and it could be a big topic come next January, February for advisors, or it could be like CRM2, where it wasn't really much of a splash, right? So it's probably good for the industry it's probably not perfect, but it's good for the industry to start to disclose to investors what their embedded costs are. It's starting point. It's, you know, trying to educate investors who, you know, aren't in our space to understand, you know, it's not free, right? Mm. You're paying for professional management. There's a cost in that. And this is what the embedded cost is. But, you know, a dollar for dollar is probably the most economic way of getting professional management that anybody could afford, you know, for anybody who just has a dollar or $100,000 or $1 million to invest. It is, you know, the economy of scales of using professional management in an investment fund is probably the most economic way I've seen.
We've always had more or less a percentage view of what that cost is. And now we're going to have a dollar for dollar view of what the, you know, those embedded costs have been. And I think it's just, you know, for advisors, it's something that they need to get around. They need to get ahead of now, if they haven't already started.
Yeah.
In terms of quantifying the cost and quantifying the value of what they do for their clients, all the services and advice, coaching, different ways that advisors add to the relationship and what that's worth, tax planning, estate planning, financial planning, and the investment planning itself. So I think, you know, this year is a year, like, I think for advisors, it's probably a tough year because you've got all this activity in the market.
Yeah.
And you have to divide your time between what's going on in the market, the activity, some of the dealing with it, but also at the same time preparing for this reporting that's coming in January, February of next year, as well, to get ahead of the curve on that. So challenging year for sure. And the Canadian ETF space, what's interesting versus the US ETF space is that we tend to be a little more careful, but a little more innovative in terms of actually solving complex problems for investors, as opposed to just, you know, catering to the fever of speculation. And so you see that, you know, in some of these covered call single stock funds, single stock ETFs, where you can actually own a stock that you like and then get paid to own it. That's actually a nice way to you know, own something that you like and make a lateral move from a stock that you like owning. What, you know, like maybe it's Shopify or something, and you buy the covered call ETF, you know, the covered call version of Shopify, and then you're getting paid. You're getting some income while you own the stock, and that's potentially very attractive. It solves a problem. It's a tool.
Yeah,
it's interesting. Like you mentioned, you know, like what is the attraction? Like it seems to be that like in the DIY market, the reason covered call ETFs are attractive to the DIY market, younger investors, but also, you know, 40 and 50 somethings and older, like the defined outcome of the covered call ETF. That's the aspect that actually behaviorally is attractive to younger investors as well as old. When you're able to own the market or own a single stock and capture an income from it that you know you're going to get, that you can plan on, there's something near term or short term about that that's attractive, but I don't have to wait. You know, I can get something now and then.
There is a generational gap, and there's instant gratification that needs to be had.
Right.
Versus, you know, I'm gonna sock away $100 a week and I'm gonna buy this stock or mutual fund or ETF and, you know, let it compound over the next 20, 30, 40 years, and, you know, it's actually gonna be worth something. They wanna see something
now.
Now.
Yeah.
It hasn't subsided. And I don't know if that's because markets have continued to be bullish, and so it's just continued to grow from that perspective. I do not wish a downturn in the market, but you'd wonder what a sustained shift in performance of the markets would do to a covered call strategy, the number of covered call strategies that are out there, right? So, I think the products, and they continue to be launched,
are doing well because the markets are doing well.
But we've had, I mean, to your point, I agree to your point that if we had a prolonged or protracted bear market, that might put pressure on it. But we've had those moments like 2020, March 2020.
Yeah.
2022, where both both equities and bonds were down in the 20s for a while. I mean, it wasn't, the market turned obviously, but you still had that not protracted, but a test, like a pressure test. And because investors saw that pressure test on those two occasions, or they can look at a chart and see, how did these things do through that period? Did their distributions get cut?
Yeah.
Did the income go down and it changed? How did the overall performance turn out? They look back at 2020 and 22 and they think, well, that's pretty reassuring because they didn't really get disrupted. But yeah, to your point, I think that's the because the underlying is equities, you do have to wonder, what does a prolonged or protracted bear market do to the trend? I'm actually encouraged, from conversations we've had with the firms that are really strong in that space. What encourages me is that they're very adamant about, stressing or emphasizing that in the end, these are long only funds. These are long only equity funds with an overlay for the income. So you still have to look at it the way it needs to be looked at as an equity fund.
Yeah.
Right.
So
don't lose sight of that. And hopefully, there is some resilience, but of course, as long as investors understand that those covered call equity fund, ETFs are equity funds at heart, that a prolonged, bear market would have an effect on that.
Yeah. And I think that's where advisors, their job is really to educate
their clients on, the type of product it is, how it's structured, what the impacts are going to be based on, certain economic impacts. And I think that's where an advisor plays a big part of their value add to an investor is, explaining, this is why I'm recommending this product over another. This is how this product works. This is how it's going to react during certain market volatility. And this is why I think it's the best product for your objectives.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Where, I don't think if you're doing it yourself, you get that same sort of education, understanding, you're really just, hopefully you're doing your own research, but if it's off of other people's research, how strong are they in actually providing, not direct advice, but general advice, mm-hmm. Are they just picking the hottest thing and saying, this is what you should buy? So, when you sort of look at historically the role advisors play for investors, it's significant. I think I read a report where anybody who had an advisor, their growth or their value of their portfolio grew like 3.6 times versus maybe down, right? So, yes, there's a cost of having an advisor, but, I think the advice
is an even greater benefit
for sure. So that's important, and I think advisors just need to make sure that they truly understand the product that's being brought to market, right? So, does it work well as an ETF? Is it giving the exposure that my client is looking for? Does it, meet their risk profile? Know your product is probably more important today than it's ever been.
Absolutely, 100%. Right?
Looking at a name of a fund doesn't really give you a good sense of it gives you a sense of what it's hoping to do, but it really doesn't tell you how it's structured, what is it doing, is there an implied or leverage in there that you weren't aware of, is it hedged, is it unhedged, how do they get exposure to that market, are all things that, people need to pay attention to.
Well, fortunately, all the information is available. It's widely available. It's high disclosure stuff. It's definitely, there's no excuse for not doing the homework. whether you're an investor or an advisor.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right. Ron, you see both like the birth and the maturation of ETF products. When you look at which new ETFs actually gain scale versus those that stall, what do you see as common traits that stand out? And
yeah,
and how should advisors interpret early asset gathering patterns when they're deciding whether to adopt a new ETF?
Yeah, so I think there's two stories around that. So there's the first to market. So, you know, you've seen a number of, you know, we'll call it innovative products that are coming in. There's a number of issuers that are trying to be first to market. The one that's first to market, and I think regulators are trying to be a little more sensitive that how important that is. The first out the gate typically gathers significantly more of the assets. Now, we understand why that happens. I think where the advisor can play a really strong role is making sure that, yes, it's gathered a lot of assets, but is that the right product for my client?
Right, right.
The other area that we see, a challenge for, challenge for any new entrants that are trying to gather assets is, you know, how well are they known, right? So new issuers coming into the market who have historically never been an investment fund manager or whatever, like brand recognition is important,
mm-hmm.
right? There is a reason why those top 10 issuers out of the almost 50 that we have now are gathering 86% of the flow, right? They have the products, they're known, they've been around for years, they have strong distribution channels, they're not necessarily reliant on do-it-yourselfer yeah. markets or channels. So having a brand recognition, having a strong suite of funds that are available that, you know, an investor can move from, you know, I want to be all in on equities, or I want access to global markets, or now I want to move to long fixed income, or have a, you know, a cash sleeve or whatever, or some, like having that suite of products is very comfortable for an advisor and for an investor, because they understand the organization, they understand their investment strategies. So that gives them a lot of comfort. You look at, you know, the number of new entrants that have come in, a lot of them now are investment fund managers with mutual funds that are saying, I want to get into this space. So at least you have a historical track record. Chances are people understand right. who the firm is. I think where your people are going to struggle now is, and especially advisors, is suggesting to their client to do something with their startup. Right? We've had some really strong, successful startup standalone ETF issuers in this market. You know, and you look at the Evolves, you look at Purpose, you look at Hamilton, Harvest.
Right.
You know, they've done extremely well. Global X, like they've done really, really well in that area. But then, you know, unfortunately we had experience with Emerge, right? So
yeah.
Clients were held hostage for 9 months.
Yeah.
Don't get out. So I think advisors are going to be like, do I really want to take a chance of putting my client's assets in a product, even though it may be good, not knowing that that firm will be around?
Yeah. And
will that fund be around?
Yeah. Well, yeah, because funds come and go, right? And
yeah.
and ETFs get shuffled and, you know, they get amalgamated into other ETF tickers, and then they disappear and your assets move and you end up with the equivalent yeah. holding in a new ETF. But can you tell are there signals or a timeline where you can tell if a new ETF is likely to make it?
So, you know,
you guys look at that?
Wait, so our suggestion when we're talking, especially to new entrants, and even if it's an asset manager who's looking in the ETFs, like you got to give yourselves 3 years, right? Like,
okay.
There's, so 3 years is, you know, I'm not saying it's a magic number, but it is, you know, it's an opportunity for people to, one, you get some track record, you get some performance,
right.
You start to get some volume. You might have launched a product that at that particular point in time wasn't necessarily needed in the market. So you may be ahead of the trend. You know, ideally you're not behind the trend, but you're ahead of the trend. Yeah. So you need to give it some time to sort of to get its legs and gather some assets. I think where you need to maybe be a little more cutthroat is if you're part of a pool of similar light products that came to market at the same time, maybe you don't give yourself 3 years. Like if there's only so many assets going into a niche product, then chances are if you didn't get what we'll call sustainable assets fairly early, then, you know, other than you may want it there because it fits a purpose, right. You might want to rethink how long you keep that around.
Because that's the cost.
The cost of running funds these days isn't getting cheaper. You know, the amount of regulatory oversight and changes that are happening that just drive the costs of running investment funds are continuing to go up. You have regulators who are increasing fees across the board for filings, especially around ETFs. You know, regulators are looking at ETFs as the next cash cow, right? They see the flows that are going in, right? They're passing mutual funds. So they're like, we need to get our cut of the pie. So, you know, that is a drawdown on the cost of running funds. And, you know, when I look at it, you know, I understand why they're doing it ultimately, but what regulators need to think about every time they're looking at a new rule change, enhancing investor protection, the need to increase fees because of oversight costs, that each additional cost of dollar impacts the investor.
Yeah. Yeah, this is the way for, exactly.
Right.
The cost.
It's just like tariffs, right? The end consumer pays. Nobody's going to, at this point, especially with ETFs and the desire to try to keep costs down and MERs down and stuff like that. Like, the cost has to go somewhere. And so the end investor is going to pay. So, you know, I think it's important for everybody in the ecosystem to think about, you know, every time we're looking to do something, what's the ultimate impact to the end investor? Because that's where it's going to hit. And that's important. And when I look at the investment fund industry versus other financial products that are out there, it is the most regulated area in the country, like I'd say in the world. You know, you got your advisors who are registered, you got the platforms that are registered, you got IFMs that are registered, and then you have all the investment fund protection that, you know, from financial reporting, continued disclosure, point of sale, TCR, like you look at all these things, and it's just cost over cost over cost, and the investor bears the brunt of that.
Yeah. You know what? It's interesting that you bring that up. And I know, you know, this is your bailiwick, right? I mean, you're intimately, you know, knowledgeable on this subject. And what is the cost impact? Like if you had to quantify it, not in dollar terms.
Yeah.
but how many basis points does TCR add to the total expense ratio of an ETF or, you know, the ETFs in general?
TCR is interesting, you know, is one thing that we did as a service provider is tried to make sure that it wasn't cost prohibitive, right? Like, you know, yes, we had to build a solution to support our clients and there's ongoing costs, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's not moving the needle. You know, I think where the true cost of development
And I don't know how this bears out for investors, is on the dealer advisor side. Like things that they never used to have to capture and hold as a data point, they now have to. That's do the calculations. I think that's where a lot of the heavy lifting is going. Like, so, you know, when we were talking to the CSA about implementation and implementation costs and how much time we would need to actually develop and build this to market, my comments all to them was, you know, our clients are fortunate, you know, and they'll say on the asset servicing side, those clients, those issuers are fortunate because ultimately the service provider is probably going to come up with a tool that's going to make it scalable, repeatable, and get the data to where it needs to go. Where the heavy lift in my mind was is on the dealer side. So it's right now getting the data, you know, if there's a change, how do you capture that? Capturing the number of units on any given day, making sure that you got the right daily cost factor, you know, how do you accumulate that over the year? How are you going to put that on a statement? That's where, you know, I would say if there's a lot of cost, that's where the cost is. And I don't know where that's going to show up in the cost to the investor.
Yeah, in the breakout.
Right?
Yeah.
Does what they ask for payment go up? Is there a transactional cost that needs to go up? I don't know, but
and it's coming at the final point, right? Because
correct.
Dealer yeah. is the final point of reporting. Like they've by the time it gets onto the statement, you know, gets into the dealer, everyone else has already reported. So the dealer's last.
Yeah,
right.
And so you know, I think what we are starting to see, and it's hard to say, and it's one of those things that we should probably spend some time as an industry looking at, is every time there's a regulatory change, what is the basis point impact to that change?
Yeah.
But we do know with, you know, the BCSC significant fee increase last year, that a number of issuers actually went and rewrote their prospectuses and their trust documents to say that those costs will be borne by the fund, i.e. the investor.
The investor.
Because yeah. they just can't afford to continue to absorb these types of arbitrary changes in filing fees. So, you know, and I think we're going to start to see more and more of that, right? Like there's only so much that we, you know, if we want to continue to have a robust investment fund industry, especially an ETF industry, that can be just absorbed by the stakeholders within that ecosystem.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to see where the pushback comes from. If it comes back, you know, does the pushback come from investors or does the pushback come from the issuers? Or
yeah, but it is they are discussions that we're having both at the federal government level, at the provincial government level, and with regulators around. You know, you have to be very mindful that everything that you're introducing is impacting Canadians and their ability to save for retirement.
So, Ron, taking a step back from the individual tickers, when you look at the combination of where flows are going and what's being built in the product pipeline, what do you think that cocktail is telling us about the next phase of the Canadian ETF market? And what should advisors be preparing for now rather than reacting to later?
Yeah, well, I think it's what you're seeing. And I was just looking at this, like obviously active is a big trend, right? So almost 60% of the products that are out there is now active. And if I looked at the SEMA's last report, I think the last 3 years, if not the last 4 years of flows into ETFs, most of it went to the active sort of bucket of a product, which
yeah,
is the price
definition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it's so, you know, I think if I'm an advisor, if they are still thinking of ETFs as passive only, and they're looking at mutual funds as their active sleeve, they may want to revisit the overall landscape around the products that are out there, and really understand whether there's a equivalent product in an ETF wrapper that would drive the same performance outcome from an active perspective to get that sort of alpha. Chances are it's going to be done at a lower cost. There's one thing about the Canadian ETF industry, there's always innovation. There's always going to be something new and innovative. And ultimately what advisors need to think about is how well does that fit into my client's account? Is it going to drive the outcome that we're all looking for?
Judging by what you were saying about 86% of flows going to the top 10 issuers, there is a trend towards working with fewer issuers out there, but with deeper benches or wider benches. Yeah. Boy, what a competitive landscape. Ron.
Yeah, it's always great speaking with you. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for your incredibly valuable time and your insight.
Thank you.